Okay, we're on our third tape. It's the last one I got, so our time is limited. But I wanted very much for you to tell a little bit about the creation of your structural engineering company, which, am I right, was the only, first and only at the time, structural engineering company in Alaska's interior. So talk a little bit about going from working all these pipeline kind of things to, and then getting your master's down at UW, and then you started your own company.
Little slight correction there. I got my master's, came back to Fairbanks, couldn't get a job, did get married to Eileen, and I think I said earlier, took a quick trip down to Seattle with my wedding suit and got a job down there. And I worked for a very prestigious structural engineering firm down there. It's called Skilling, Hilly, Christensen, and Robertson. And they are a worldwide firm. They designed tall buildings everywhere. They actually did the design for the World Trade Center. Did a lot of high-rise work and big project work. And I had been disturbed when I left Fairbanks that there was articles in the paper about how the city of Fairbanks needed an office structure, and the city and the borough both, and perhaps they should build a 8 or 10 story building in Fairbanks. And the prominent architects in town wrote letters to the paper and said, there's nobody in this town that could design an office building that big. And I thought, God, it sounds terrible. So I was determined to go work at a real big structural firm and learn how to do that stuff. Anything I learned in Fairbanks was going to be very provincial. So I was very fortunate to get this great job at this great firm and work on a lot of fascinating projects. I worked on, the tallest one was the 76-story Seafers Columbia Center, still the tallest building on the west of the Mississippi. I designed all the floors in that building and most of the non-gravity columns.
What does that mean, design the floors?
Oh, all the steel beams. All the steel beams and decks and frames and everything else, the structural members.
And the columns?
The gravity columns. The lateral force resisting system includes both seismic and wind forces and some gravity load. That was done in a different model, and another guy had that part of the job. So one person doesn't design everything on a job like that.
So that, the lateral loads are things that make it push on it sideways.
Yeah.
This way, but you worked on the gravity?
Yeah, so each floor, you know, and this floor is a varying floor plan as it goes up the height of the building, has a different framing system. I mean, there's several the same, but every 5 or 10 floors or whatever, the floor framing would change, and you have to redesign, you know where the columns are, you have to redesign the beam spans and beam spacings. It's a different size beam. It's a different size cantilevers for the corners. It's different loads, and sometimes different loads. Computer floors or storage floors or mechanical floors or whatever, and some so fairly complex, you know, some of it fairly uniform because it's office like but when you get near the near the bottom, you have some really tall columns in the lobbies and very varying floor plans, and I worked on all of those too, you know, very large steel columns and dump the loads into the foundations.
So you'd take a look at what the loads were, and you'd calculate we had to make a span this long and support this much weight, and we need an I-beam so thick, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I worked on I think a 25-story building in San Francisco, 580 California Street. Worked on a lot of hospitals, VA hospital there in Seattle, and became a project manager on the King County Correctional Facility, which is a 19-story concrete frame, downtown Seattle, and just a lot of really good projects, you know, good project experience.
So you had an office component where you're designing these things, and then you'd go out to the site and see that it was in fact built that way?
Yeah. But I, you know, you become a cog in a wheel in a big firm like that sometimes, and I kept feeling like, well, this is fun, you know, but these jobs take a year to design, and by the time the year's up, you're kind of sick of them. And I missed Fairbanks. And I thought, well, in 83, we decided to just drive up to Fairbanks for the heck of it. And so we loaded up the kids in the truck, and Michael was only 6 weeks old, and we drove up to Fairbanks and spent a few weeks or 3 weeks up here. And I noticed that there really wasn't any structural engineering firm in Fairbanks. There was a couple of guys who were working out of their houses, and that was about it. And I thought, you know, for a town this size, there should be more than that here. And a lot of the projects, any big project, still was designed in Anchorage or Seattle. Wasn't designed in Fairbanks. Structural projects. I can't say only, but most. And so being young and ambitious and slightly crazy, I decided that we were going to move back to Fairbanks and start a firm. And we went back, and I waited a year, and then in 84 came back up, moved up my stuff in a U-Haul, and not a lot of money when I think about it. I was more optimistic than I probably should have been. Started my firm, and was helped out by Tom Rosa Duke, who had a civil engineering business in town. He let me move into his building, and right where I am now, at Aurora, 1028 Aurora Street. And Tom gave me a little tiny office to work in, and didn't even charge me any rent.
Really?
And I was able to start trying to do projects, you know, and get whatever I could. I did some house inspections and some housing reports for real estate companies, which I really didn't like doing at all. And I got lucky, got a job from C.B. Bettesworth doing a building called the Utility Services Building now, or Utility Services of America Building there on University. And I got a job from a guy named, architect named Wilson, adding the fifth floor and elevator tower to the Denali State Bank building, which was a very nice job. And pretty good size, 5-story building. And it just grew from there. I mean, it just grew. There were some tight times, but I was able to always somehow manage to get another job before we ran out of money. And it was not a very, you couldn't see very far ahead. But it grew relatively fast, and I got to the point where I started hiring people. You know, John Paulson quit where he was and came to work for me, and Pat Reinhardt came. Pat came right out of school and came to work for me after he did a student project with me. So by the next year, and I had a drafter, next year or two, there was four of us. Pat Reinhardt, Maureen Lee, great gal. She helped me out a lot. And
dates here, Jim.
That was 1984. I started in June And that was the beginning of it all, with absolutely nothing. Nothing to my name. But...
You had that partner Ron there for a little while?
Yeah. There was a guy I worked with at Skilling, Helly Christensen and Robertson, who also wanted to get out. And he stayed down in Seattle. I think he went back to grad school. Stayed for 2 or 3 years. Maybe 3 years later, he came up. And I invited him up to become part of the company, and it became Loftus and Daily. And he came up to Fairbanks for a while and then opened up an office in Anchorage.
That's Ron Daly.
Yeah, that was Ron. That didn't work out, just business-wise. It was actually pretty hard to break into the Anchorage market. And I don't remember how many years we did it as Loftus and Daly, but we both finally realized that that wasn't going to be a financial situation that worked. And John and Ron moved on, and of course he's still a very successful engineer. But we were able to grow the Fairbanks market and start doing the big jobs in town, you know, and over the years, I'm pretty proud of all the jobs we've done, and we've gotten to the point where we are well known as the big and the firm to go to for large projects. We did the courthouse downtown, the parking garage downtown, and of course that Centennial Bridge across the river, the very elegant post-tensioned one. We recently finished the life sciences building at UAF and currently doing the new engineering building addition. We did the museum on the campus, which was one of the most challenging structures anybody could do. It's a world-class structure. With no claims on the structural steel.
What does that mean?
No, there were no claims for errors on the drawings.
On the part of the client?
On the part of the client or the contractor. And it was an extremely challenging project.
Was Paulson on that a lot?
He was. John played a big role on the museum project. We did all the hospital additions that have been done out there for the last 15 years. All the additions and upgrades to West Valley and Lathrop High Schools, the Birch Hill Ski Building, several of the other health centers in town. Just a lot of really nice sized buildings, the kind of practice you'd want to have in a town like Fairbanks. And the projects don't have to go to Anchorage and Seattle anymore. And goes to a team of really good engineers who live here and participate here and live in the community. And I'm particularly proud of that, that aspect of the firm, that we've been able to maintain that level well for a long time. And it just came from learning the work ethic of working at the big firms in Seattle and bringing that work ethic up here, which really wasn't up here before. I mean, the know-how, the methodology, we've influenced this town quite a bit. So it's been a very rewarding career in that sense.
Take a quick break here, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're back. And I'm sort of going to cook a little lunch here because I'm getting starving. but I'll try not to clank the pots and pans and keep throwing questions at Jim. And you said, you know, you gave a neat list of a lot of the major structures in Fairbanks that people know. And said you guys did them. And say a little bit about what that means and if you have any examples of particular projects and specific problems and how you guys attack them.
Well, we've done quite a few structures that are unique in Fairbanks. The courthouse, for instance, architect had a layout there that, just because of the nature of the building, had five different towers, elevator and stair towers, that had to be spread out in the building. Just because you can't let your prisoners and your judges, say, mingle in the same elevator, or the witnesses and the attorneys. I mean, in the public, you ended up having with these separate elements that are required for the program of the space. And usually on a building like that, and a steel building like that, you see the primary steel holding up the building, and you would put cross bracing in the building to take the lateral forces, again, the wind and seismic forces. So our real observation was that, you know, given the size of this building and the number of these towers, we could use these towers and reinforce them specially and then eliminate all the cross braces. Cross braces create huge problems with architectural systems. You have to go in front of windows a lot of times, and they cut hallways, and they get in the way of the floor plan.
You're in the headspace.
Yeah. And we told the architects that we could design this thing without any cross bracing, and they were amazed. And we said, yeah, you could do that. So for that project, they basically brought in a slip form of construction in the summer, and got all the concrete done, and had all five of these towers cast and placed before the winter came on. And they stuck out of the ground. We used to call them the five fingers of God. Sticking out of the ground, as tall as they were. And then come spring, they fabricated the steel over the winter, brought the steel in, welded it onto the concrete frames, and it went up really fast. And they were just overjoyed at how quickly it all came together. That was a pretty unique structure. The parking garage, of course, we used post-tensioned concrete where there hadn't been a... That's using high-strength steel draped through columns and beams to carry the load in the geometry of the steel when you pull on it after the concrete is cast. Pushes the slab up and the beams up, and it gives them a reverse curvature. You could, and then when you get the downward load on it, it levels out.
Putting it like a bow in it on the load side, so
yeah,
like an arch.
Yeah.
And when you say the cables draped through the concrete, through like a tube or something where you can pull them later.
Yes. Not particularly unique anywhere else, but it's not done in Fairbanks. That was probably the first post-tension job in 15 or 20, 25 years in Fairbanks. There haven't been very many of them. And a similar type of construction, we used post-tension concrete on the Centennial Bridge. The Centennial Bridge was a very challenging job because they didn't want us to put a pier in the center. And the only way to construct this bridge was to cantilever these forms out and cast this bridge in segments. And each time you cast a segment, you had to run post-tension strands back to the base and hold that section up with a new force while you then moved the formwork ahead in 14-foot increments out across the bridge. It was extremely challenging.
Explain that to me again. Tell me that again.
What you have to do is launch this bridge out from the pier. The pier is right on the bank. It's got a roughly, I think, 80-foot backspan. And cast 14 feet at a time from each end until they meet in the middle. And getting them to meet in the middle is not an easy thing to do. And each 14-foot section has to have its own set of post-tensioning cables way up near the top that you yank on back at the base, and it lifts the form up. And then when it lifts the whole thing up, then you can release the form, drop it down, launch it forward for the next piece. And that's a whole new load, too.
Isn't the form different as you move along the bridge? I mean, does it taper?
This particular form is triangular, and the base of the triangle, the underside, comes up every time. It's all built on hinges. And yes, every single form is different, but they use the same formwork, and they use hinge technology to get the shape that we want, that we wanted.
Did you guys design the forms?
No, they're designed by a company in Seattle. But it was challenging because of many things. The temperature during the day would heat up the top of the concrete and cause it to curve down. And you had gravity loads wanting it to go down. There's changes in behavior in the concrete as it cures each week. So you have to run an analysis every single day of the entire bridge, taking into account changing concrete properties, changing post-tension properties, temperature of steel, temperature of concrete, and look at the camber elevations and get your camber. You want to cast it just a little bit high so when they come together in the middle and they start sagging, they meet. By far the most challenging surveying and analysis type of structure you could build.
And that has been built in Fairbanks?
Yes.
Say that.
That has been built in Fairbanks. That was a terrific job. We really loved that job.
Now, just wondering if you get paid as well as you deserve to be paid when you have something that difficult?
No. We lost money on that job. We lost a lot of money on that job. And it's probably been typical of the very unique jobs you get. And it's not on purpose, that's for sure. I think when you're a firm like ours that doesn't do a lot of one kind of thing, you end up being optimistic about how much time it's going to take. And that was certainly true of the Centennial Bridge. And it was true of the museum, too. The museum was a challenging job, and just the shape. I mean, just look at that geometry, and you know that thing is complex. And our solution there to all of the problems that we faced was that we would make the first floor solid concrete, including a concrete lid, which was some rather large concrete beams and columns and frames, because they generated a lot of noise in their rock crushing labs and everything else, and you don't want that noise getting up into the gallery space. And the top gallery space was structural steel, which has numerous cantilevers off of the concrete. And it also has the inverted and truncated cone shape of the store, which is off that small piece off to the right side. So the geometry was created by the architects, and they asked us, how are we going to make this stand up? And our solution to the problem was to make it a three-dimensional structure, which was like a basket weave. And we locked it together as a three-dimensional structure using a series of round columns and cross braces. And the cross braces could then intersect the round column with the same connection no matter what angle they came in. And every angle they came into was a different angle. But the idea, connection was the same.
The idea is you have perhaps curved members intersecting, and I'm just imagining bands of steel that you could put a rivet in wherever they intersect, and you end up getting the kind of strength you get out of triangles.
You could have used curved members. We didn't. We found a way to use straight members, which made it much simpler to build. The columns all slope out from the bottom to the top, but the connections were simpler because they were pipe columns, 14-inch diameter pipes. And so no matter what angle that the next horizontal member came in at, both vertically and as it went around the curvature, it was always a different angle, but the connection was exactly the same because it was coming into a pipe.
And what was that? I mean, did it make a sleeve that had received bolts?
Yes. Yeah, there was a bolted connection there. And I mean, that project was full of challenges like that, geometrical challenges and multiple complex details to work out with the architect. We put in redundancies here and there to take into account perceived potential problems with construction. And it was fortunate that we did. In some places, the contractor made a mistake with anchor bolts. And if we had left one set of braces in instead of putting that second one in that we thought really would be appropriate, there could have been problems with one of the major cantilevers. But as it was, everything worked out perfectly fine. It was just a very difficult job to work on.
Are there names for the shapes that building assumes?
Well, there's several different ones. They call them, one of the analogies is whales. There's little orca and big orca, you know. One of the other analogies is icebergs.
But I'm thinking geometric terms.
Only for the store, which is a truncated cone. So you take a cone, point down, and you make a vertical slice through it, sloping outward. And then at the top, you make a curved slice through the top to bottom. And those curves were hardly ever anything geometric. It was at the pleasure of the architect. So, I mean, it does start with a mathematical shape that you can calculate. And the rest of it is calculated just by using models that the architect came up with and software that generates coordinates for the shape that's left when you're done. That's for that small store area. The large one, the larger, taller piece, what they call the big orca, is really a flat wall with a pure horizontal curve at the other face. It goes straight up. It doesn't slope out. There's the newer things we're doing in town. We did the Mount McKinley Bank building downtown, and that was the very first use of a new type of buckling restrained braced frames, which is a type of frame technology that makes a very efficient use of steel and wonderful behavior under wind and seismic loads. We've used that same technology at both the engineering building and the life sciences building. They were the first buildings ever in Alaska to use this technology. We put in the first steel moment frame buildings that met the current code, seismic code requirements, quite a few years ago at the emergency department at the hospital. And I've since done the same thing, same kind of moment frames at the new Tanana Chiefs Clinic, which we just finished. And the engineering building has moment frames in one direction and buckling or restrained brace frames in the other direction. So there's been a lot of unique technologies we've used up here that haven't been used anywhere else in Alaska.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, we're just about at the end of this tape, so I'll switch it off and we'll eat our hamburgers. And then we'll go to side two and the last side. Okay, we have eaten our lunch, and we're about picking up maybe an hour later here. Beautiful sunny day, but still is a little gusty. We're back outside, and we're going to see if we can do it without the wind messing things up, because it is so nice here. Chena flowing by, dim. Pussy willows are out, birch leaves are out. Beautiful early summer day.
It's a beauty. River's flowing. Smells good. Sounds good. Everything is right.
Okay, I'm gonna. Okay, here we go. Seems like it's all right with the wind. So we had last kind of run through a list of a lot of the major projects that your company. Actually, I guess we should hit this briefly. Your merger. How you became the entity you are now, and then I thought maybe we'd move off of the work history. So maybe talk a little bit about you had established your own firm, pretty small shop doing structural, and then of course this list includes the new entity. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I guess 84. I started my own firm. And it was a lot of fun. I built up a really great staff of people, and I enjoyed what I was doing. And but I had an opportunity to merge with a couple other three firms actually, in 1998. And I thought that it would be fun to try something different. I mean, they had mechanical, electrical, and civil, no structural. The name of the firm at that time was FPE Rowan, and they were a merger of two other firms, Fryer Presley Engineering and Rowan Design. And we were all in the same building. And I thought, yeah, let's do something different. Let's change. And we merged, and then I negotiated a merger with another firm, Lake and Boswell, which is an electrical engineering firm in Fairbanks. So there were, by that time, four firms in this together. And we've been in the same building and since 98 now, and it's been a good firm. It's we've continued to grow, and we've been getting lots of good projects all over the state.
Say the name of it.
It's now called PDC Inc., which stands for Planning, Design, and Construction.
And about how many people? There's
about 40 people in each office. Total revenues grow. You know, it changes. But roughly $14 million of work flows through there a year.
40 people in each of
How many offices are there?
There's only two, 40 in Anchorage, 40 in Fairbanks, roughly.
Okay. So one of the things that I think about when I think about you in this job over the years is the responsibility that falls to you. You know, you read just recently in the news, a bridge over I-5 in Washington State collapsed. There was a big collapse of a bridge in, was it Minnesota, I think. Once in a while you see, I think there was a, was there a Hyatt Hotel or something that had a collapse, and a bleachers in a stadium. And I wonder how that all weighed on you.
A lot. You can't be a structural engineer without recognizing the responsibilities that come with designing a structure correctly. And I tell my guys always that we can never be wrong. We have to be right about everything that we do. And there's lots of different kinds of mistakes that can be made. On the design side, you know, it can be maybe you don't know the subject matter very well. The second thing might be you don't apply the rules of design correctly, even though you might know them. And the third thing in general category is blunders and mistakes. So you have to set up a system to be very careful and thorough about checking all of those things. And challenge each other, which is one thing I like about having an office with lots of engineers. And you challenge each other about things, and you check each other's work, and make sure that you don't have mistakes, and that you are doing things correctly. There's no excuse for not doing that.
I'm thinking that you might have had a suitable personality. Take on that kind of difficult responsibility. Is that, we'll go, just thinking back over our conversation here, the kind of work ethic you developed when you went out to become an Eagle Scout, and when you became a track athlete, and the discipline and the training, at Skillings, same thing you talked about at very strong work ethic you got there. Speak to that.
Well, self-evaluation is never hardly anybody's strong suit. I can't say that it's mine. Those things you say probably are indicative of somebody that thinks about those things. I guess I've had an awareness of the importance of doing those things right since college days, and I have a particular passion for structural engineering. I think everybody who gets into it does. People don't casually drop into that profession. You care about your structures a lot. You care about perfection and correctness, and it's part of the whole picture of what you do. It's not something you add on later that, oh, maybe I should care about this. It comes core with your passion for the profession.
So I think a person listening to this could start to isolate some themes that have to do with the commitment to doing things right, a willingness to work hard at that, and a willingness to absorb a lot of responsibility. And one of the things I know, knowing you, I think I do, is that the place where you have also done that, and I would say, probably you would say, a place that matters even more than in the workplace is in your family. And you have been somebody who has absorbed the responsibility for kids and all, and has worked kind of without, in a very selfless way, to take care of them, to absorb the responsibility as the father of a pretty good sized family.
Yeah, I, again, you know, that self-evaluation thing. I don't think about it as a decision I have to make every day when I get up. It's inherent. It's like the most important thing. It comes first, no matter what. The commitment to taking care of the family and recognizing your role as both a husband and a father. They become so ingrained in you that you sometimes forget you're doing them. Maybe you forget even why you're doing them. But it would be hard to say that you don't take that as the most fundamental thing. And I hope I always did as good a job as a person could. You never think you're doing great when you're a parent. I'll bet every parent probably thinks that, but you do what you can, and you be there, and you develop your relationships as with your kids as they grow up, and you adjust that relationship to who they are, and learn to accept them for who they are, not for what you want them to be. And they are who they are, and that's a rich and rewarding thing to do. Be the father of children, and it's a rich and rewarding role to be a husband. We've been pretty lucky as a family. We just have a really tight-knit bond there of six people who are very different in many ways, but tied very closely.
Wind is blowing pretty good, and I just want to check, make sure it's coming out all right. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I know. Where to begin? Over the years, I've talked to you about retiring and taking it a little easier because you had such a stressful job, not only just doing structural engineering, buildings and structures that can affect the safety of the public who use them. But you're also one of the principals of this big, you're getting pretty big company. And before that, you were the principal. And so you had all that. And lots of stress and big load of responsibility. But you never were interested in that. Well, I mean, it seemed to me like you certainly reached a point where you could do without the stress and the headache, but you felt you had to do it really for the family. That's the read I got. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. The family, and I mean, certainly some thoughts about the future. Being in private practice, you don't walk away with any kind of help from the government or a set-aside pension or anything like that. And so there's always some sense of, you know, I got to work long enough to see that I think that I've saved enough that I'll be fine. I mean, nobody has the answer to that equation, and too many variables, really. But there was always that sense. But there was also always a sense that I enjoyed what I was doing. And it was fulfilling, too. I mean, it wasn't, I can't deny that was part of the reason that I stayed. Between those two factors, I stayed till now, and I have no regrets about it at all. I liked the work I did, and I liked the people I work with, and our lifestyle was great. who's to say that maybe I would have been wiser to leave a while ago? I don't know. Those are the kinds of questions, you know, you can't really understand. Or maybe you just can't answer them yourself, you know. You get caught up in your lifestyle and you just decide what you decide, and some things you just put off, and because it's an easy groove to be in. Hard to be conclusive about such a comment.
So, what happened yesterday? Sort of bring us up to that.
Yesterday, I went in and quit my job. Is that the one you meant?
Yep.
Oh yeah, I almost forgot. Well, obviously, the cancer that I got back in September here has made a bit of a difference, you might say, in my life. And took an initial path that everything could be fought and perhaps cured, and that has proven recently to not be the case. And so there is no need to continue working, and I may have a relatively short life to live from this point on. And I don't need the responsibility. I don't want it. I want to just enjoy each day as it comes. And I feel good now. Hope I feel good as long as I can. And it's a different kind of way of looking at everything, really. But for sure, I don't need the distraction of a job. And I have other things to do and think about and focus on that are going to be very fulfilling for me.
Maybe say a little bit about that.
Well, the initial thing is to enjoy every day and enjoy this lifestyle I have. I mean, I don't have this giant bucket list where I got to climb Mount Kilimanjaro tomorrow or do anything else. I mean, taking the time off work to come out here and sit by the Chena River is just a huge luxury. My life has been great, and I intend to enjoy my life without the stress and hassle as much as possible. There's interests that I've had all along that I never quite seem to put the time into that I want to, like some of the philosophy reading I like to review and study and talk about. And I've been wanting to pick up some kind of painting, believe it or not, lately. We'll see if I get that kicked off. Never done anything like that before in my life. And
you mean fine arts painting?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a house painting.
Yeah, the house does need a painting, but I probably might not do that. Yeah, I don't know. And there's a few health issues I have to deal with. And I intend to simplify and enjoy the day, you know. And I'm very well positioned philosophically for whatever comes ahead of me. I feel good. I have a good attitude about whatever happens. I'm going to plow ahead and enjoy everything. And there's a lot to enjoy. Heck of a lot to enjoy. It's a no regrets kind of a thing, you know. Did what I did, and I'm happy I did it.
So, another mutual buddy of ours taught philosophy at the university for some years, and you kind of engaged in a independent study, kind of informal independent study with him couple years ago, maybe talk a little bit about that and then bring that back into what you had just said about the position you're in now.
I've always had an interest, I think I mentioned loving to read novels from high school on, and interested in thought-provoking, contemplative literature and writers. And never got into it too much. It was hard to read when the kids were around and you're doing homework and with them and taking care of the family. And since they've grown up and moved out, I've gone back to some reading that encompasses the fields really of spirituality, where I kind of started, and lately more into philosophy, because when I started reading the spirituality stuff, I realized I didn't have great a background in philosophy as I wanted, and it interested me, and it's not something they teach you in engineering college anyway. So I would say 6-7 years ago, I started more on a serious study of philosophers in a sequential order to build a foundation for that, the thought processes. And 2 or 3 years into it, I started talking to John Kustra, who you mentioned, started asking him some questions about what book do you think I should read next, and he suggested I come over and talk to him. So we set up a formal deal in the winters where I would come over to his house every Sunday at noon, and we'd talk for an hour about the guys I was reading and how they fit into the spectrum of philosophical thought and what it all means, and, you know, just get more meaning out of a guy than just trying to read his book. And of course, conversations are much more difficult than just simple input reading wise. And these have been very fruitful meetings for me, and it's been rich, and all as thought provoking as I would hope to, and helped organize how I think. And all that kind of stuff seems to come into play now more, well, I don't know more, but it does give me an overview of my condition and the condition of people, and a certain level of wisdom, I hope, or give it another word, I don't care, but some insight for me into the workings of the world as a whole. And it makes you less self-focused. It makes you more focused on some kind of a unity that is a challenging subject for philosophers throughout time, and even now. I mean, there's no sense going off on what I mean by that, but a universe, a tie to the universe, a tie to everything, and a losing of the self, so to speak. All actually very peaceful and like I said before, rich for me.
I was thinking, in the little time we have left, what a phrase, huh, Jim?
Yeah.
That you might, I guess I was thinking, we mentioned yesterday, you know, you would have liked to have seen grandchildren, and so I was just wondering if you had anything to say to those yet unborn.
Will they know what a tape recorder is?
Dub it to whatever medium that you use.
Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, you could come across very authoritative and tell them to brush their teeth and comb their hair and obey the rules. Yeah, I would. I think that that would be a wonderful thing to hold a grandchild in your arms, to watch them grow up, to play that role, to be perhaps influential. Every kid is different, of course, and every one of them would be loved. I would want them to develop an awareness of the world around them that's bigger than themselves, and follow that rich path of contemplation and thought that sometimes seems to be missing in the world. Whether I'd be able to do that or not, I don't really know. You know, I might be the old geezer that they run away from and say, "You don't have to go see that old granddad, do we?" But yeah, that they would grow up to be aware of things and fulfilled and happy, and it would be a joy to have been able to participate in that, if I could.
And so now I'm thinking, we never actually mentioned, I don't think, either your kids, and maybe sort of introduce them a little bit.
We didn't, did we?
What you think about when you think about each one.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That last part's a tall order. I'm sure your tape recorder's not long enough, but the oldest is John Aaron. Currently a CPA in Portland. The second one is Oliver, and he's a land surveyor living in Fairbanks. Third one is Michael, and he lives in Seattle. He's a cook, and in a couple of different bands down there. He's quite the musician and the artistic one. And the youngest is Claire, who is married, lives in Fairbanks. And they're finest and greatest and the best kids in the whole world. What else could I say about them? They are so understanding and stalwart and very different in their personalities, but get along completely with each other. And Eileen and I, and so lucky to have those four kids. Can't imagine what life would be without them. It just wouldn't really even be worth living. I've really been fortunate in having kids that are so forthright and clear and funny. Understanding, yeah, that is a truly wonderful thing, beyond what words sometimes could express.
And Eileen.
Eileen who? I am amazed that I've had as wonderful a wife as I have. I know that on a tape like this, you could say something really corny just because you want it to be on there for the archives. It's hard to dodge that bullet. I think back on my whole life, I can't think of anybody else that could possibly have loved me more or treated me better than her. I mean that in itself is a wonderful thing. And I learned what love is from her. I don't think I really knew it before I got married. And she taught me. And that's a lesson in life that you don't get from just anybody. You get it from somebody very special. And she's that special one. She found that way to teach me and to and help me live my life. And I'll love her for eternity. And like I said, it's, you can run into lots of platitudes here, but a pretty unbelievable and wonderful relationship has ensued for all these years. Mm-hmm. And I am really lucky.
She's about wound down. Jim, are you about talked out?
Yeah, I think I am. I don't know where I'd go from here anyway. there's no particular stories that need to be told right now, and I hope this all wasn't as boring as it probably is going to sound, but it's been an interesting experience for me to go through this process, and I want to thank you for taking the time to do it. I'm extremely curious to see what it sounds like. It's not anything I've ever done before, so thanks.
All right.